Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. The introduction in the book, The Thinking Moms Revolution, says, quote, "Our children are sick and need help. We are fighting to make them well and need doctors who can provide us with the tools necessary to treat these ailments. The Thinking Moms Revolution is about taking back the health of our children, whether they have autism, asthma, sensory processing problems, or any of the other disorders that are found so frequently in our children today. We ask that as you read the pages of this book, you do one very important thing. Think." End quote. The Thinking Moms found each other online and learned that they are not alone. They're working to take their children back from things like autism, ADHD, sensory disorders, and mitochondrial dysfunction. They write, "One day, we all hope that the tie that binds us together is a new reality, recovery. Some of us are already there." The Thinking Moms Revolution is made up of 23 moms and one dad, and their group stretches from Montana to Malaysia. The statistics are staggering. Over 50% of homes with kids experience some form of chronic illness or deal with a special need. 300,000 children have a seizure disorder. NPR ran a story about seizures this morning. From 1997 to 2008, there has been a 289% increase in autism, and that number comes directly from the CDC. So on today's Your Call, we are talking with the Thinking Moms about what it will take to advocate for children with special needs and what has their experience been like. Today, we are joined by Allison McNeil. She's a psychotherapist. In 2011, Allison participated in a six-part autism documentary that was produced and narrated by her father, Robert McNeil, formerly of the PBS NewsHour. And it's called Autism Now. Allison is co-founder and author of The Thinking Moms Revolution. And in a video, she talks about her son suffering from the top of his head to the bottom of his feet, things like seizures, mitochondrial dysfunction, and inflammation in his brain. And Allison joins us from Lake Tahoe. Hi, Allison. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Actually, I wish I was in Lake Tahoe. I'm in Cambridge, Massachusetts.
Oh, you're in Cambridge.
But that's okay. I'll go to Lake Tahoe any day.
Thank you. I got you flipped. Well, thank you for joining us.
That's okay.
We're also joined by Megan Davenhall. She's co-founder of the Thinking Moms Revolution and now focuses her efforts on educating others about autism, its causes, and ways to help kids who are affected. Her son is extremely small for his age. He was prescribed antibiotics for ear infections, more antibiotics when he was young, and it resulted in terrible diarrhea and horrible digestion as a child. For 2 years, he stopped growing. Hi, Megan. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Thank you so much for having us.
Thank you so much for joining us. So, you know, I was riveted by the book, and I have to say, I just did not know that these issues were so pervasive. And Megan, in one video, you talk about that 50% stat, that over 50% of homes with kids experience some form of chronic illness or deal with a special need. I mean, that's a staggering statistic.
It is staggering. It's quite scary. We dismiss so many of the health problems that are going on with children today as normal. It's now normal to have a kid with asthma in your house or a kid with debilitating food allergies. And it's something that shouldn't be happening. Kids should not be having the difficulties with breathing, you know, running around in the playground. They shouldn't be having this much trouble with things that were really rare as we were growing up as kids. I didn't know anybody who had asthma and needed an inhaler, and now the health room drawers are filled with inhalers and EpiPens. So it is scary.
Well, is it because we didn't really have good information and medical advances, say, 50 years ago, or is it because these things just didn't exist back then?
I don't believe they existed back then. It is something that is now pervasive throughout the country and throughout the world. I didn't know anybody who had a life-threatening food allergy growing up, but there are kids in every single classroom across this country with life-threatening peanut allergies. There are kids in every single classroom across this country who have debilitating ADHD or who have autism. And I can tell you just from looking at my son that his problems are medical. You don't stop growing for 2 years and have everything be okay. He has systemic problems with his health.
And before we dive into the details, Allison, can you also talk about just how pervasive this issue is, especially for people who might not have children or maybe either don't know parents with kids, or maybe it's because they don't make it public, because that's another problem.
You know, I think there have just been a couple of conversations I've had over the last year or two that have really driven the point home for me in a very concrete way. At my daughter's school, my daughter is just about to go into seventh grade next year. Her school nurse said to me last year, this is an elementary school, she said, "Allison, 10 years ago, I would have one EpiPen in my drawer every September. A parent would bring one EpiPen in." And she said, "Now it is standard for me to have at least 40.
And what is an EpiPen?
An EpiPen is something you would use in a life-threatening emergency for a child that has an anaphylactic food allergy or allergy to an environmental toxin. Primarily, the scariest ones are peanut allergies. And, you know, we all know that when we went to school, we didn't have children dropping dead from peanut allergies. We didn't have classrooms that needed to be peanut-free. The rise of these allergies is very real. It is very, very scary. You know, so in terms of is this actually a rise in numbers, or is this a rise in awareness? If we had one out of every 33 male adults, we have one out of every 33 male children is autistic now. If one out of every male adults, one out of every 33 male adults was autistic, we would see them. They would be all around us, flapping, in diapers, unable to communicate. We would see them, and we don't see them because they don't exist.
What are the numbers when we're looking at autism? Because another staggering stat from the CDC found that from 1997 to 2008, there has been a 289% increase in autism. Do you have the updated numbers from 97 to 2013 or 2012?
Well, what I do know is the statistic that is one out of every 50 children is autistic, and that with that, the understanding being that one out of 33 children, a male children, is autistic, that's actually a measurement of children that were born in the year 2000. So we know that this data is already old.
And that one out of 50 children?
Yeah.
So let's take a step back here and talk about how you all came together. So you're out with this book, The Thinking Moms Revolution, 23 Moms and One Dad. Talk about how you found each other. I understand that you were just desperate for answers and you all went online and went into Yahoo groups, went on Facebook and found each other. Can you talk a little bit about that, Allison?
Right. So we did find each other. Some of us were working with certain providers and sharing different kinds of treatment and suggestions about that. And we became a group, and it was one of those things. It was a sort of, what if we each wrote the story of our child's regression into autism, or in the case of several of the children in the book, into other developmental disorders. And I think it's the real difference between saying you're going to do something and actually doing it. And part of the difference for us, I think, is we have terrific leadership in our group. Helen Conroy, who goes by Goddess in the book, has a wonderful ability to sort of manage, and she really made this happen. She just very sort of, in a very loving way, kind of kept it moving, kept the project going. And every step of the way, we sort of said, God, I wonder if we could possibly edit this thing. I wonder if we could possibly get a publisher interested, you know. And each step of the way, we sort of made it to the next step and thought, my God, we're really doing this. This might actually happen, you know. And we've been as surprised the whole way along. My God, someone actually bought it, you know. You know, even today, my God, we're on NPR.
How did you find The Thinking Moms, Megan?
Same way. We were really, I would say it was 2 years ago that there was a group of us that was in a particular Facebook group for this one practitioner that we were seeing. And we, you know, we needed to find answers because, unfortunately, when you go to the pediatrician, there are no answers in the pediatrician's office. You get told that your child has autism, and then you're told to have a nice day. There's nothing that they have to offer by way of treatment. But there are providers out there that do. And so we searched and searched, and through this Yahoo group, it stopped being about only looking for answers for our kids, and we became friends. And when we were able to all get together at one of the autism conferences, that was really where the idea about the book was born. Someone said, hey, we should write a book. And lo and behold, here we are.
And you know what's striking in these 23 stories? Every child has, you know, his or her own issues and background, obviously. But there are so many themes running through all of the stories. And one is that when a lot of the moms and dads go to the doctor, they're basically told, oh, this is just a basic side effect. Don't worry about it. Oh, in a year, your daughter will start growing. It's just normal. Oh, in 2 years, don't worry, your daughter will start talking. I mean, everybody got these same answers. Can you talk a little bit about that, Allison?
You know, I think that as a group, there is a theme that we were on the whole, pretty let down by our pediatric community. And I think many of us were shocked to find out that there was far better information. It did exist. We had to find it ourselves. And it was parents often who led us in the right direction to providers that had more information. My son regressed after the MMR, the DTaP, and the HIB vaccines at his 15-month appointment. Within 10 days, we had really lost him into autism. And I was in and out of my pediatrician's office about 6 times between his 15-month shots and his 18-month visit. And so this was literally happening in front of them, and it never occurred to them that this was a vaccine injury. And to this day, I don't think they would agree with me.
So talk a little bit more about your son. You, in the video, you say he suffers from the top of his head to the bottom of his feet.
He's been through hell, like so many kids with autism. I mean, Megan's son has gone through much of the same stuff. Megan's son and my son both took a lot of antibiotics, which really, really compounded the situation for Nick. And I know Megan has strong feelings about antibiotics as well. So for Nick, you know, I think it was a situation of total toxic load. So basically for Nick, I mean, he has inflammation in his brain. He has issues with his vision and tracking. I'm just sort of starting at the top of the head and going down. He had mitochondrial dysfunction, absent seizures, lymphoid nodular hyperplasia, which is a fancy way of saying inflammation in the small intestine, terrible issues with gut motility. He became sensitive to many, many foods and also chemical and environmental toxins. He's low tone. I mean, I could just go on and on and on. But what I want to refer back to and remind you guys that this child was born healthy, and at his 15-month visit at the pediatrician's, before he was given those 3 huge shots, the nurse practitioner had written in his chart, meeting all developmental milestones, this boy is on track.
Hmm. How old is he now?
He's 8 years old.
And so we'll talk about what you found online and how he's doing. But first, Megan, why don't you talk to us about your son and what he dealt with as an infant?
Yes. Well, and like Allison's son, like Nick, Rob was born completely typically developing. I actually had a conversation with my pediatrician. It was probably around 15 months of age, and I questioned the MMR. I said, you know, so what's the connection with autism and these vaccines? And, you know, the doctor said, oh, it's not the shots. And sat there with my son happily playing with him and said, well, you don't need to worry about autism with him because he didn't have it then. What happened with Rob, we did not lose him dramatically the way that some kids regress into autism. He started ear infections around 8 or 9 months of age. And we treated every single one with antibiotics. And what I did not know about antibiotics at the time is that not only will the antibiotics kill the bacteria that is causing an infection, it also strips the body of all of the good bacteria, all of the good flora in the gut, and really leaves the child open to a host of problems. For Rob, it was really the failure to thrive and lack of growing. And so we treated these ear infection after ear infection after ear infection with vaccines. And going back through his records, he received vaccines while he was on antibiotics, which is a no-no. You shouldn't be getting any vaccines while you're sick. And he was getting vaccines while he was also sick with ear infections at the time. So it was a very slow demise for him. We really didn't notice anything was off at first. And we feel fortunate that Rob never lost his language. He's always been able to communicate with us to some extent. But it's been a really, really long process getting him back to a level where he can function. We're still trying to get there.
And how old is Rob now?
Rob is 10. He just turned 10.
In some of the stories, moms talk about their kids not even talking until the age of 5.
Yeah.
And the red flags really didn't go up until after that happened, or until they got a diagnosis from another doctor. And the other theme, and again, this was really sad to read, is that the majority of the moms blame themselves because they trusted the advice and they said, okay, well, I'll wait another year. Maybe they're just a little slow and she'll come around. Megan, it seems like there is a lot of blame where the moms look around and say, well, I'm the only one to blame because I didn't trust my gut, basically.
Absolutely. I think that's probably one of the hardest things as a parent to get past, to be able to forgive yourself for what happened. Because your job as a parent and as a mother is to protect your child. That's your instinct. That is everything, you know, that you're, it's the mother bear instinct that every mom has. And really, we do. A lot of us feel like we failed because we should have known. I should have known that antibiotics, given in that amount, would have done something to him. But I didn't research. I trusted the advice that I was getting in the examining room. And really, I should have done more. But again, in hindsight, you know, there's not a whole lot that, there's nothing productive that comes out of blaming yourself. So it's something you have to come to terms with and move on.
I think if I could just interject something, I think in the society, there's a lot of support for the mother blame with autism. I mean, it goes back to the sort of ancient ideas of the refrigerator mother, which actually still exists in some parts of the world with autism, like in France. But, you know, your pediatrician has zero liability if your child is injured from vaccination. So, you know, if they even file a vaccine injury report, which they only do one out of every 10 times that they're reported. It's only one-tenth of vaccine injuries are even reported. If you even go so far as to go to the vaccine injury court, which is a real kangaroo court, I mean, it doesn't work. So let's say you go that far, the court almost never awards in favor of the parent for a vaccine injury. So really, if you're the mother of a child who has fallen apart through the course of vaccination and the overuse of antibiotics, you know, you're left blaming yourself because no one else is going to take any blame.
Hmm. Today we are speaking with members of the Thinking Moms Revolution. Megan Devenhall is co-founder and focuses her efforts on educating others about autism, its causes, and ways to help children who are affected. Her son Rob is now 10. He's extremely small for his age. After being prescribed antibiotics for ear infections, he suffered terrible diarrhea and horrible digestion as a child. For 2 years, he stopped growing. Allison McNeil is a psychotherapist. In 2011, she participated in a 6-part autism documentary called Autism Now, produced and narrated by her father, Robert McNeil, formerly of the PBS NewsHour. Her son, Nick, is now 8, and he suffered so many things from the top of his head to the bottom of his feet, seizures, inflammation in his brain, mitochondrial dysfunction. And these moms and one dad found themselves online just simply by asking questions and to figure out how to heal. And they're out with a new book called The Thinking Moms Revolution, and they will be speaking tomorrow at the Commonwealth Club in San Francisco at 6:30. You can find more information at yourcallradio.org. The reception's at 5:30. The program is at 6. And we'd love to hear from you. If you have a child that has a learning disorder or an illness, what has your experience been like in trying to find answers and trying to help your child heal? We'd love to hear from you. The toll-free number is 866-798-8255. If you're a doctor or a member of the pediatric community, what are your thoughts when you hear parents say that they felt like they just didn't get answers and they were told, well, wait a year, this is what happens? We'd love to hear from you if you work in that community. 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. And did you know that 50% of homes with kids experience some form of chronic illness or deal with a special need? What explains this, and what questions do you have about why this is happening? George in San Francisco couldn't stay on the line, but he wanted to know if there's a correlation between the introduction of GMO foods and the increase in developmental disorders. Allison, have you found information about GMOs in your research?
Well, I'm really worried about GMOs, and frankly, I think every mother is. I mean, I think the issue with GMOs is starting to trickle down to, you know, just to, it's just a pervasive. We are worried. This is an experiment, and we don't know what the outcome is going to be. I do know that there's some pretty compelling research that's coming up about the pesticide Roundup, which is it's used extensively with GMO crops. And so and there is some pretty compelling research about Roundup and autism coming down the pike. I do think it's very interesting that most autistic children cannot digest wheat or dairy, and I often wonder if one of the reasons that kids do so badly on these grains is because the majority of these grains that they're getting in regular supermarkets are GMO. My concern about toxicity in our kids really has come to include, you know, just about everything. You know, I hate to feel sometimes like the tinfoil hat wearing mom, but I'm worried about fluoride. I'm worried about all kinds of stuff. So I am definitely worried about GMOs.
And just to let you all know, we're going to be joined soon by Dr. Bob Sears, who's a pediatrician, so he can also answer some of these questions, specific questions about things like GMOs. Let's also talk about experiences in social settings, because in the foreword, Dr. Sears says, you know, reading this book will make you a better person. Next time you're in a grocery store and see a six-year-old nonverbal child having a complete meltdown, instead of frowning and thinking what a bad job that parent is doing, you can go up to them and say, I get it. I don't have a child with autism, so I don't totally get it, but I'm trying. Can I give you a helping hand? That was the other thing that was really striking in the book, Megan, is that you have to deal with all of these social settings. And those of us who are on the outside kind of look at you like, what's happening with your child? And, you know, not realizing that you're dealing with a lot of pain, and it's incredibly difficult. So can you talk about some of your personal stories?
It's a very big challenge, especially for parents that have a more volatile child on the spectrum. Those of us that have been doing this for a while, we recognize the signs of what a meltdown looks like as opposed to a tantrum, because, you know, you're not getting a toy. Let's face it, kids go through tantrums. Not every meltdown that you see is a child with autism. There are kids that have tantrums out in public. That's been around forever. But the difference is that a child with autism cannot regulate themselves and get themselves out of that place where they're melting down. A lot of times it looks very out of control. I had a situation in Target not that long ago.
Actually, hold that thought. We're going to take a quick break.
Oh,
and
sure.
We're speaking with members of the Thinking Moms Revolution, inspiring true stories from parents fighting to rescue their children. And if you're dealing with a child who has a special need or a learning disorder, we'd love to hear from you. What has your experience been like? If you work in the pediatric community, what are your thoughts? How do you deal with parents who feel like they just can't get answers? Where should they go for answers? It's your call. We'll be back after this.
This is Your Call on Local Public Radio. It's always a better program when you get involved. If you have a question, idea, or experience to contribute to today's conversation, please call 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-TALK. You can also send an email question or comment to feedback@yourcallradio.org.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up tomorrow, we'll have a conversation about the Trans-Pacific Partnership. This is the United States' latest trade agreement that's not getting much attention because so much of it has taken place behind closed doors. A lot of advocates are calling the Trans-Pacific Partnership a supersized NAFTA that allows foreign companies to override domestic laws on environmental health and citizens' rights. That's tomorrow. On Wednesday, we'll talk about conditions in immigrant detention centers in the United States. And then on Thursday, we will be talking about the NSA spy programs. And who knows, when it comes to Thursday, we might have some new information because things are happening so quickly. So that's on Thursday. And if you have a show idea or a guest idea, you can drop us a line, feedback@yourcallradio.org. Today, we are speaking with members of the Thinking Moms Revolution. The introduction in their new book, The Thinking Moms Revolution, says our children are sick and need help. We are fighting to make them well and need doctors who can provide us with the tools necessary to treat these ailments. We're talking about autism, ADHD, sensory disorders, mitochondrial dysfunction. Over 50% of homes with kids experience some form of chronic illness or deal with a special need. NPR had a story this morning about kids dealing with seizure disorders, 300,000. The CDC's numbers say that from 1997 to 2008, there has been a 289% increase in autism. So if you have kids that are dealing with some kind of learning disorder, what has your experience been like? What has your experience with the medical community been like? Where are you turning for help? And how is your child doing? And if you work with the medical community, we'd love to hear from you. The toll-free number is 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org or leave a comment on our website, yourcallradio.org. Today we're joined by Allison McNeil, a psychotherapist. In 2011, she participated in a six-part autism documentary called Autism Now. It was produced and narrated by her father, Robert McNeil, formerly of the PBS NewsHour. Allison is co-founder, and she also contributed to the Thinking Moms Revolution. Megan Davenhall is a co-founder of the Thinking Moms Revolution and now focuses on educating others about autism and its causes. And the Thinking Moms will be speaking tomorrow night at the Commonwealth Club in San Francisco. 5:30 networking, 6 o'clock is the program. And you can find more information at yourcallradio.org. And it's 595 Market Street, downtown San Francisco. And Megan, before the break, we were just talking about societal problems and meltdowns. And you were about to tell us about a story that took, or about an incident that took place at Target.
Yes, as I was saying, there's a definite difference between a meltdown and just a regular run-of-the-mill tantrum. And we've been fortunate and haven't had very many of these incidents, but the one day at Target, my son just was in sensory overload, and he was losing it. He was starting to get really agitated, started to get really upset, and I just kind of handled it really calmly and just focused all my attention and energy on him. And I was fortunate that there was a mother who recognized that it was sensory. And she came up to me and said, "You're doing a great job." And that was all I needed in that moment, just to know that, okay, someone here gets it. I'm not standing here alone feeling desperate to try to help my son through this. So I think it is, it's something that unfortunately people are going to see more and more and more of as they go out and about in their communities, because the numbers are definitely on the rise. I mean, it is in every neighborhood across this country. You're going to find a kid that is on the spectrum.
Allison, do you want to share any stories before we get to calls?
Yeah, I just was going to say, you know, when my son was really little, I could kind of put him on my hip and just kind of hurry him through the motions if he were was having a really hard time. But he's 8 now, and so it's much harder if he falls apart in a public space to get out of there without kind of drawing a lot of attention to ourselves. It's also harder, generationally, I don't think that people that are my parents' age are really used to seeing this kind of behavior with children. I had a woman who was probably in her late 70s at Whole Foods start lecturing my son when he was really falling apart, again, total sensory overload, about having very poor manners. And at the time, my son was really falling apart. I mean, he was on the floor and he was kicking and stuff. And I was just looking at her. My jaw was kind of on the ground. I was really hurt and really upset by it. And then I was walking out to my car and I realized she's never seen this before. She has no idea that she's lecturing an autistic child about manners. Hmm. She thinks that I'm just a really poor mother.
Wow.
You know.
Well, we've got a number of callers on this issue. So let's hear from Jenna in San Francisco. Hi, Jenna. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Can you hear me?
Hi, yes. Go ahead.
Okay, thank you. I just wanted to put my two cents in about my story. I have a daughter who has sensory issues, so I know you guys haven't talked about that that much yet. So she's verbal, good with skills. She's about four, almost four and a half now. And my husband and I went to talk to her pediatrician when she was about a year and a half just because of her intense tantrums. So I can totally relate to the meltdowns. It's a different degree of tantrum, these meltdowns. So we also felt really discouraged and a little condescended to, and didn't find much help with our pediatrician. And just, you know, same thing, thought like, well, maybe she'll grow out of it. And she doesn't meet any of the criteria for any autism or autism spectrum disorders, but just the inability to cope or transition. But she does have food allergies, severe allergies to nuts and sesame seeds. But again, she's meeting other developmental milestones and academic ones. But it's different when you feel really alone and don't have much help. And we eventually saw a psychologist who said to us, have you guys ever heard of sensory issues? And we said no, and kind of educated ourselves a little bit and learned more, and eventually got hooked up with an occupational therapist. But this is all out of pocket. It's something that for us, sensory issues aren't recognized by the DSM, so we can't use insurance. So that's another facet I just wanted to throw into the mix.
Yeah, I'm glad you brought that up, because so many of the moms and the dad in the book talk about the financial constraints and how difficult it is. And Jenna, I just wanted to ask you, where are you turning for information?
Well, I have a good friend actually on the East Coast who had children who also struggled with behavioral issues, like not ADHD and not autism, but she opened our eyes to sensory issues. And we had just done our own search after feeling like, you know, reading all these disciplinary books and nothing was working, like 1-2-3 magic. We just decided to find our own psychologist. And she was the one who mentioned, you know, have you heard of, she came over to our house and witnessed our daughter's behavior and said, have you heard of sensory issues? And when we said no, just researched it on our own and then tried to find occupational therapists that would call us back, because occupational therapists are basically overworked and underpaid.
Well, thank you so much. You might want to check out The Thinking Moms has a Facebook page, and they have a dialogue about everything you can imagine. And they also have a Twitter page. But check that out, because I know that they're dialoguing. Many say that sometimes they wake up in the middle of the night to talk about what they're dealing with, and someone is online to have a back and forth. So thank you so much for calling. Let's go next to Lizzie in San Francisco. Hi, Lizzie. Is it Lizzie? Let's go to a doctor calling from Berkeley. Hi, Maria. Welcome to the show.
Hi. How are you doing?
Good. How are you?
I'm good. I'm calling because I'm a little bit concerned about the fact that it seems like there's some promotion of misinformation right now that vaccines actually lead to autism, or that antibiotics lead to autism. And the vaccine issue, I just think we should be clear and cautious about, because it's essentially the link between vaccines and autism has, for all intents and purposes, been disproven. And I don't want to take away from the experiences of the mothers and the parents on the show and the difficulties they're going through with their children, but I think we have to be really, really careful about the good that comes from vaccine as opposed to the idea that they lead to autism, which, again, has not been substantiated after huge, huge clinical trials. And, again, the issue of antibiotics. As a physician, I don't promote the widespread or unnecessary use of antibiotics by any means, but I think, again, we need to be careful about the linkages that are being made on this program.
Well, Maria, stay on the line because this is really important. And I also
I'd like to make a comment.
Yeah, is that Megan?
No, this is Allison.
Oh, Allison. Actually. Allison, go ahead.
You know, I think this is a very, very contentious issue. And I think there's a lot. I think we're going to learn a lot over the coming years. But in fact, we studied the MMR and we studied thimerosal, but nothing else has been studied in the vaccine schedule. And the vaccine schedule has actually never been studied as it's implemented. So to say that there have been huge, huge studies is actually not true.
Well, there have been very large clinical trials that have studied, again, thimerosal and the MMR, which
that's two out of an enormous schedule.
Well, you know, I'm not disagreeing with you there, but I feel like, a lot of the other information, like, the onset of recognizing symptoms that are associated with autism happens to occur around the same time that certain vaccines are given. And also, I think we need to talk about the fact that a lot of the issues around the increasing prevalence of autism spectrum disorders probably some degree of increasing prevalence, and there is also a huge degree of increase in detection and definition, and how the disorders are defined, and so that a lot of things that in the past may not have been called autism spectrum are now being diagnosed and called autism spectrum because of an increased recognition of the symptoms in the medical community.
I'd actually like to speak to that for a second. I was a teacher before I had kids and taught for a while, and I really think if you want to hear a good account of the numbers and whether or not there has been a change, is to talk to the teachers, because the teachers year after year after year in the classrooms. And I can tell you that some of my colleagues that have been in the field for, 20, 30 years, people that I taught with, that I've been close with, they will tell you that there are marked increases in autism and in severe ADHD and in food allergies and in asthma. It's not better detection. There is a rise.
Well,
from the time that I started teaching, I never had a child with autism in my class. Never. My son went to preschool. It was just a local preschool at a local church. There were 10 children in his class, and 2 people were affected. 2 out of 10.
Again, I mean, this is, you can speak from your perspective, and I can speak from my perspective, and everyone can speak from their own perspective, and it's a little bit anecdotal, and I think I frankly think it's a dangerous thing on the air, on a widely listened to and respected show like your call, not to present the other side and to promote the idea that vaccines are somehow unsafe when, the Gates Foundation and many other organizations across the world are trying their best to implement increased vaccines in underdeveloped countries where these diseases that have been scourges are not completely eradicated and kids are unnecessarily dying because they don't have access to the vaccines we have access to.
And Maria, just to be clear, Megan and Allison are talking about their specific circumstances. We're not saying that there's a connection between A leads to B to C. They're not saying that at all. But I'd like to ask you as a doctor, I mean, when you look at these CDC statistics from 97 to 2008, a 289% increase in autism, just in your opinion, what explains this? I mean, that's a massive percentage increase.
It is a massive percentage increase, and I'm not a pediatrician. I'm an emergency physician, I am a mother of 2 young school-age children, and I think that they're, I think that there may be something to the fact that something environmental was going on. Characteristics of, perhaps parents, people are giving birth at later ages, and there's been a little bit of research in that arena. And then finally, I do think it's important to note that there's been a changing definition in what defines someone as autism spectrum. And so I think there has been a rather large increase in the way that the disease itself is being defined.
and the characteristics that are defining kids and giving them that diagnosis, whereas before perhaps some of them wouldn't have been diagnosed in that manner. And I think the same thing is happening with ADHD. I think that there is, and I'm not necessarily talking about severe ADHD, but I think there is a current issue going on with a lot of kids getting diagnosed with ADHD and put on potentially harmful medications, when in fact, given a little bit more time, they may be just exhibiting normal childhood behavior. And I saw that somewhat in my own experience with looking at kids that my son has gone to school with. So I think we just have to be cautious about the way we're defining these things and the way that we're treating things that may not need to be, may not be treated with medication.
Well, thank you for calling, Maria. That's Maria, a doctor from Berkeley. And Megan or Allison, did you want to jump in there?
Well, just a couple of things I wanted to say. I mean, we have this idea that a lot of people said to me when I said my son regressed at the time of vaccination, they said, "Well, Allison, that's when autism hits. That's just when it happens." In the same way that we look at schizophrenia as often kicking in when kids are right about the same age that they go off to college, right? So, I bought that for a long time, and then, I started to really think about it, and I did a lot of reading about it. And, if you look at it, there was no such thing as autism until we hit the 1940s, and right around the same time was the beginning of our heavy-duty vaccination program. So is this really just when autism begins, or is this actually something that went hand in hand? I could kind of go point by point with the pediatrician, but I think that she's quite firmly grounded in her belief system, and perhaps because my son fell apart in my arms and I was, the person who drove him to his vaccination appointment, you might say that I am as well.
I think part of the problem that I have is that these kids, they have the social disorder of autism, which is really a social label, but they have all of these comorbid health problems. They have gut dysbiosis. They have food allergies. They have seizure disorders. Mm. They're sick. This is not just my son's a little quirky. He's ill. Stopped growing for 2.5 years.
Right. I mean, that's the other thing that came out in the book, is that we're talking about so many disorders, not just one. I mean, children, you name it, slamming their head against the wall, taking feces and spreading them on the walls, breaking mirrors in their sister's room. I mean, you name it. And that's what these kids are dealing with. And again, this is not a show about vaccines. I mean, these parents are dealing with ADHD, sensory disorders, various dysfunctions. They stopped growing. And this is really about mothers asking questions.
Our concerns are much greater than vaccination.
And also, the other thing that really struck me is that a lot of moms, after years of trying such a wide array of possible so-called solutions, they actually did find certain things that worked. And so, Allison, what was your experience in looking at, homeopathy, for example, or going down a different route?
Well, what we found is that we have had some tremendous help from some of this stuff that I was told to avoid. I was told it was hogwash, that it was for the wackosphere, but actually, changing my son's diet has been enormously helpful. Homeopathy has been a terrific help for my son. Some mainstream medications for things like treating yeast and Clostridia, those are two gut infections that become rampant for kids when they lose all their good gut flora from too many antibiotics. So some mainstream medications, but for my son, we have benefited from having a very open mind and doing lots of reading. And my husband and I, basically, when we're looking at treatments, we think about, okay, so is it safe? Could it hurt him in any way? Can we afford it? Is it feasible? And if we can answer those questions in a way we feel comfortable with, we give it a try. And we've been really pleased with my son's healing. I now have an extremely healthy 8-year-old boy. Mm. He has a diagnosis of moderate autism, but he is healthy and he is happy, and that was not the case several years ago.
And Megan, what about you?
Diet. I mean, diet's a really big,
big piece to this. If you go in the grocery stores and look at what's on the shelves and what's inside the food that we're feeding our kids, the chemicals, the artificial colors, the artificial flavors, the GMOs, it's not stuff our body can process, and it's not things we're meant to have in our systems. For us, we had to do a very strict diet, pinpointing the inflammation in my son's gut. And we changed his diet, and he started eating because he wasn't in pain anymore. Mm. I mean, he started actually being able to eat. And, I mean, we did something so simple when we first started realizing that this was a medical condition we were dealing with. We read up about cod liver oil. After 3 months of my son being on cod liver oil, his eye contact returned.
Yep.
He was looking at us straight in the eyes. His eye contact is wonderful now, and it took 3 months of cod liver oil. There are so many things that we can do to help our kids, but it's up to the parents to go out there and look for them.
That is Megan Davenhall. She's a co-founder of the Thinking Moms Revolution and focuses on educating parents about autism. Alice McNeil is a psychotherapist. She participated in a 6-part documentary called Autism Now, and they are contributors to the new book, The Thinking Moms Revolution. They will both be speaking tomorrow night at the Commonwealth Club. The event starts at 5:30, and it is at 595 Market Street in downtown San Francisco. And now I would like to welcome Dr. Bob Sears to the show. Dr. Sears is a pediatrician and a medical advisor for Talk About Curing Autism and author of the Autism Book. He runs the Ask Dr. Sears website and Facebook page. Hi, Dr. Sears. Welcome to the show.
Hey, thanks for having me on.
So I know you had patients all morning. Thank you for finding a little bit of time to join us.
Yes, sure.
You know, Dr. Sears, I just want to ask you, how did the vaccine issue become so incredibly controversial?
Oh, well, that's a great question. I would say in regards to autism, the whole vaccine issue blew up with a publication of a research paper that showed that MMR vaccine might be triggering some inflammation that could be linked to autism. I think that's sort of what got the vaccine ball rolling. I would say a little bit earlier than that, though, it kind of, in the early 90s, as the vaccine schedule started to escalate and we were giving kids more and more mercury-containing vaccines, parents started to question that practice as we started to see autism begin to increase. I'd say those are kind of the two factors starting in the early 90s.
Well, and it's just, the statistics are kind of mind-blowing, Dr. Sears. I mean, over 50% of homes with kids experience some form of chronic illness or deal with a special need. 300,000 children have a seizure disorder. What do you expect is going to happen in the next couple of decades? I mean, is the medical establishment really taking these issues seriously?
You know, they're taking them seriously, but I'd say they're being a little bit too slow about it. I've been a pediatrician for 16 years, and when I first started practicing, even then, the late 90s, I wasn't seeing nearly as much chronic disease and developmental disorder as I'm seeing now. Mm-hmm. There has been this huge escalation. And unfortunately, I do think the medical community is very slow to respond to this. They're slow to acknowledge that it's happening, and they're slow to start investigating the reasons why this is happening.
Why?
You know, that is a great question. I have no idea why. I mean, I think many of us kind of agree that this escalation in developmental disorder and chronic disease is largely due to our environment, environmental toxicities. You know, it's a lot of things you guys might have been talking about earlier today. I wasn't listening in. I was working. But pollution, chemicals in the environment, chemicals in our foods, heavy metals in our foods, what all these chemicals are doing, as well as medications, are just overloading our genetic systems and our immune systems. Mm-hmm. And they're just causing this degradation in our health. And I think ultimately cleaning up the planet, going back to how things were before the Industrial Revolution from a chemical standpoint, is what we need to do to really fix our species, for the long run. That's going to be an extremely slow process, but I think that's probably the ultimate answer. And for now, all parents can do is try to keep their kids as organic and green as possible to try to limit these chemical exposures starting before pregnancy, through pregnancy, and then in children's early lives. So they're affected by these chemicals in as limited a way as possible.
And Jackie writes in and says, don't forget that hundreds of chemicals now test positive in umbilical cords. So, you know, this has gotten a lot of media attention over the years. We have just a minute and a half left, so 30 seconds each. In closing, Dr. Sears, what can parents do to advocate for their children?
Well, I think in regards to autism, parents really need to look at gut health, food allergies, definitely supplement with some key nutrients that you guys have been talking about. I've seen kids' autism turn around dramatically when parents go on a casein-free, gluten-free diet and they start some of the key nutrients like cod liver oil, B12, other B vitamins, magnesium. Those are some of the keys. But you can do things for autism. You can help resolve it, help fix it. You don't have to just look at it as a lifelong diagnosis.
And Megan, what would you add to that? When you feel like you're not getting the answers you want, what's the best way to advocate for your child?
Oh, it's just to not give up, just to keep looking. I mean, there are so many resources out there. Do an internet search. Find a local TACA group to get involved with. Get on our Thinking Moms page and connect with people that are doing this, because everything that I learned from other parents. I found the resources. I found the practitioners that could help me. So just don't give up. Keep at it.
And Allison, quick final thoughts?
Yeah, somebody said to me when my son was first diagnosed, they said, it's the parents that will get you through. And those are the truest words I've heard.
Allison McNeil is a psychotherapist. Megan Davenhall works on educating parents about autism. And Dr. Bob Sears is a pediatrician. And the new book is The Thinking Moms Revolution. They'll be speaking tomorrow night at the Commonwealth Club in San Francisco. 595 Market Street starts at 5:30. Thank you all for joining us.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
And thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call. Support for Your Call comes from the listeners of KALW. To sign up for our podcast or newsletter or to share the show on Facebook or Twitter, visit yourcallradio.org. Malihe Razazan and Ali Budner produce the show. Matt Martin is our executive producer. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer. And Joe Burke is the studio engineer. Our theme music was composed and performed by Live Human. Your Call is produced by KALW in San Francisco. Special thanks to our partners at KUSP in Santa Cruz. You can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org.